Thanks for listening to The Rest Is Politics. Sign up to The Rest Is Politics Plus to enjoy ad-free listening, receive a weekly newsletter, join our members' chat room, and gain early access to live show tickets. Just go to therestispolitics.com. That's therestispolitics.com.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics Question Time with me, Rory Stewart.
And me, Alistair Campbell.
Very good. Well, here we go. I want to start with Alejandro Dominguez. What do you think of Trump's interview on Univision, which is a very, very major Latino television station in the US? How will Trump's portrayal affect the Latino vote, Alistair?
Well, the reason I suspect why Alejandro Dominguez is asking this question is because Trump did this huge interview on Univision, and I don't know how to describe it. I think it's fair to say he was given a reasonably easy ride, which suggests that the new ownership of this station is on the turn.
Who weirdly are close to Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So there's obviously sort of, you know, I mean, Trump is a bit like all these sort of right-wing populists, same as Farage, utterly obsessed with media, utterly obsessed about sort of using media to profile themselves and project themselves. And of course, this is the channel that Trump had objected to their previous star interviewer, Jorge Ramos, because he was absolutely gunning for him over the whole build a wall stuff. So it seems like they're on the move.
And Trump's racism. I mean, Trump's, you know, basically absolutely implied that Mexican immigrants are terrorists or gun-toting people. So it's extraordinary that the Latino vote may be shifting towards him. There also seems to be evidence that the African-American vote is shifting slightly towards Trump. And Reid Hoffman, who we interviewed on Leading, the founder of LinkedIn, was saying to me over the weekend that this is the only thing he's really worrying about over the next year, is how to do what he can to make sure Trump doesn't become president of the United States. He says at the moment, he feels like they're playing Russian roulette with 3 bullets out of 6 in the chamber. And his hope is to get it down to 1 bullet out of 6 in the chamber. He says you still wouldn't want to play Russian roulette with
explain the Russian roulette.
So his idea is the most a 50-50 chance of Trump becoming president, which is basically like shooting yourself in the head. And he wants to reduce the chance down to 1 in 6 from 50%.
And how do you do that? Where is he on the sort of Biden to run, Biden not to run?
Well, he thinks at the moment there's no way out, that so long as Biden wants to run, there's nothing that can be done. I mean, people made a real concerted effort back in the fall to try to persuade Biden to step down. He's not prepared to do that. The polling does suggest at the moment that Biden is less popular than another Democratic candidate would be, although, of course, polling's a bit unreliable at this stage because you don't know what would happen. New candidate came in. But one of the relevances of this is that a lot of it will come down to whether stations like Univision start putting out pro-Trump propaganda will make a huge difference. And it's not just Fox News. It's all these other right-wing media stations will be critical for this vote, and then social media and AI.
One of the things that the Democrats and other liberal Latinos really objected to is, for example, in this interview, Trump constantly claiming that the election was stolen and so forth, and there was no pushback at all. Now, the defense of the station was, well, you know, that stuff's been kind of done to death and what have you, but it was definitely, it was perceived as a big shift by a major media player in the Latino.
Just sort of quick ones, because we do think about this a bit, don't we, when we interview people, you know, whether we're interviewing Tony Blair, how much time we spend talking about the Iraq War, or doubtless when we interview Kwasi Kwarteng, how much time we spend talking about his omni-shambles budget. How do you as a journalist get the balance right between having a open interview where you get the person talk about themselves and also landing the points in you, because it can be very mechanical, can't it? When you watch some of the BBC interviews, sometimes it can be just, we feel we have to ask the following seven things to prove that
we're... Yeah, and they become really, really boring. Maybe related to this is a question from John. Ministers' media briefings. When a minister is sent to a TV show, radio broadcast, are they briefed on the phrases to use and how to dodge questions? I mean, I think Trump is a very, very difficult interviewee because he doesn't mind lying. He likes to create distractions. He has his own talking points that he relentlessly pushes. I suspect they will have made a judgment. I mean, it sounds to me like they made a judgment to go soft on him. They were pleased to have him on there, and they knew it would get written about and talked about and be seen as a big political event.
Might they actually have agreed to go soft on him as part of the negotiation to get him on?
Entirely possible. Entirely possible. Although I don't think Trump... I think Trump's one of those people who doesn't really care about the question. He just pushes back in whatever way he wants. But look, it's like when you and I talk to each other about Iraq... And I said to you before, I didn't think I was being asked anything I've not been asked before, but people listening did. Now, I think that's about the tone. If you'd have been the Today programme, if you'd have been Newsnight, even before I got there, I'd have been in a mode.
Yeah.
And it becomes boring very, very quickly. I think what people like about our interviews, by the way, in fact, somebody said this to me at an event I was at last night. They'd listened to the Angela Rayner interview, and they said, what I like about your interviews is there's enough of your presence in there, you and me, without it being overwhelming. You're genuinely interested in what the person has to say about their life. Whereas I think what happens with a lot of media interviews is basically the journalist is doing it for other journalists.
Right.
Am I going to impress other journalists by asking this really tough question?
And often
in this
they're
way?
Trying to get a line, aren't they? They're yeah. hoping to, they've sort of, there's three or four lines.
We don't really care about it.
Three or four lines we're hoping for, yeah. Right, well, here we are. Thoughts on the developments. The civil war in Myanmar. Anti-junta rebels appear to be gaining lots of grounds. How can a lasting peace be built with so many rebel factions, many splits on ethnic lines, or wanting independence?
It can't.
Yeah, I mean, so just to remind people, I mean, of all the horrors in the world at the moment, Myanmar is one of the least reported and most horrifying. So, quick reminder, military government for many decades. Then Aung San Suu Kyi was the lady, came in this sort of democratic revolution, disappointed many people because of her failure to condemn the genocide against the Rohingya, and was then toppled by a military coup and is now in prison. Since the military government took over, the country has collapsed into a horrible form of civil war. And Myanmar is defined by a Burmese heartland, ethnically Burmese heartland, and then a whole series of different minority groups around the fringes. So in addition to the Rohingya, Shan, Kachin, Karen, Chin, many of them along the Thai-Chinese borders. So we're now in a situation in which drugs are involved. A lot of these groups grow opium poppies, warlords, Chinese money. China's very, very dominant in Myanmar. All of them now fighting the Burmese army, along with a very, very brave, genuine, democratic, liberal group of people with 3D printed weapons out trying to take on the military. I mean, it's horrifying.
Mm.
And I was very optimistic about Burma in 2014, as was the British government. And, you know, I remember seeing 2012, 2013, thinking how much potential that country has. Incredible natural resources, perfectly located, very educated, could have been like Thailand or Malaysia or Indonesia, one of the great Asian success stories, instead of which it's stuck in horror.
And as you say, falling right off the international radar because of the focus on the Middle East, just as Ukraine's falling off the radar.
It could be a classic example for the UN to get involved, but for this one to be resolved, it needs China and the US to speak, because China's the dominant power there.
Yeah.
And of course, the US isn't prepared really to talk to China, nor vice versa, about this kind of issue.
Yeah. Now, more, not happily, because the content is a problem, but a happier subject. Tree Equity Score. James from the Woodland Trust. Are you aware, Rory, of the Tree Equity Score? Just launched in the UK by the Woodland Trust, American Forest and the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare. And the fact that the areas which need the benefits of trees most have them least. And it's an interesting, we should put it in the newsletter. It's a thing where you can go online and you basically can, you can measure the density of trees and the benefit of trees in your area. I'm very lucky. I live in a very nice...
leafy area.
Fairly leafy. Hampstead Heath on our doorstep. And so we've got a very good tree equity score. But it's, you can see, this goes back to the sort of point about inequality. You go to the poorer areas in the country and they are worse off for trees.
Yeah. And trees are so good for everything, aren't they? They're great for biodiversity. An oak tree can have over 1,000 species in it. Great for air quality. And of course, great for carbon capture and climate. So it can actually clean up the air pollution. So absolutely, we need to plant more trees. And I'm always struck when I go to Paris that they're much more inventive about getting trees into the streetscape.
Mm.
I noticed that Sadiq Khan is making moves in that direction, but we should be moving much, much, much faster.
They're also very good for my social media feed and my tree of the day.
Tree of the day, famous tree of the day. Yeah. Now, yeah. IPP synthesis, Donna, what impact will Alex Chalk's suggested amendments have for those serving an IPP in the community and for those stuck in prison? So IPP is just to remind people, these are sentences which were introduced by David Blunkett in the Labour government, where effectively for a minor crime, you can be detained indefinitely. And then when you're released from prison, you can be put on a license period of 10 years. And if you commit any offence during that 10 years, you can be brought back to prison. So for many prisoners, it seems like an interminable life sentence where they may have done something quite minor and they're just stuck in the system forever. They have very high degree rates of suicide, people dying in prison, and it's fundamentally inhuman and completely in contravention with the way that the law should work. You should be sent to prison for a set sentence defined by a judge, not just locked up indefinitely.
David Blunkett had an interview in, I think it was in the House magazine, and he basically has said that this policy has been a disaster and that the problem is that the judges used it, he says, in a way that was never intended. They were thinking this was going to apply to a small number of people, and it's turned out to have been applied to thousands. And as you say, thousands of people often ending up with instances of really serious self-harm and suicide.
And although it was abolished by David Cameron in 2010,
we're still dealing with the overhang.
13 years onwards, we still have an enormous number of these people within the system. And it would be a lovely thing to see in a Labour manifesto when they come in as the next government to see them actually clear the sentences for all those people.
Yeah. Now, you confidently predicted not long ago, I seem to remember, in this very studio, that a certain Enfarage was going to be crowned the King of the Jungle.
That's right.
Merian Boyle wants to know, is the fact that Nigel Farage is in the final of a programme like I'm a Celebrity a sign that the Tory right might still be a lot more popular than we think with Middle England? Now, first of all, would you like to apologise for your false prediction?
I'd apologise to listeners. And in fact, it was very striking. There was I saying he's definitely going to win. And our production...
And what did I say?
Well, you said no. And our production team, who really understands this stuff inside out, was like, no way, there's no way. And they had some very complicated explanation of why Farage couldn't possibly win.
Although I saw that GB News had a thing on there when I was channel... I never stay longer than a second when I'm channel hopping, but they had a thing in the corner. You had to put your phone against it. You could get 5 free votes to vote for Farage.
5 free votes?
I don't know how it worked, but they were trying to rig the vote for Farage.
That's rubbish. So Farage came third.
Yeah.
And I noticed that some of the newspapers were running, I think it was The Sun, ran a huge front page with a picture of Farage, mentioning in smaller type that actually he hadn't won. But the front page basically gave the impression that he'd won the whole thing.
We also saw the lady in his life.
The lady in his
life? She flew out there to greet him. And he flew straight back to do a really tough, rigorous interview with Richard Tice on Talk TV. So the leader of the Reform Party interviews Farage about how terrible the government are on immigration. So I don't know that I think he's less popular. I mean, the truth is that ITV are putting this down as £1.5 million that wasn't a very good investment.
Oh, he didn't get the viewers?
Well, they lost 4 million.
Oh, gosh. And is it basically that, apart from Farage, these shows are beginning to tank, that people are watching them less and less?
My God, I hope so. I really hope so. But I don't know. But they apparently Ant and Dec have decided that there should be no politicians in future. So I'm afraid, Rory, you won't be going on I'm a Celebrity next year.
I'm getting the most extraordinary number of offers for the most bizarre shows at the moment. And it's only my respect for you that stops me going on these various things.
Well, Rory, just put this in your head now. If the choice is between money and reputation, go for reputation every time.
Well, that was not the choice made by the people discussed by Nora Smith's question. Can you explain what's going on with the European Parliament's investigation into the Qatar Gate scandal? So given the choice between money and reputation. So in Qatar Gate, there's been an extraordinary range of figures, including Antonio Panzeri, former member of the European Parliament, a woman called Eva Kaili, who's a sitting member of the European Parliament, all bribed in order to influence voting at the European Parliament in favour of Qatar. And I think they've been arrested, allegations ongoing. We probably have to be careful making legal statements on this, but it is a mesmerizing case. Mm. It appears that Antonio Panzeri took 2 million euros in bribes from Qatar and Morocco in order to get a friendly resolution towards Qatar and Morocco in the European Parliament. Extraordinary that they think it's worth 2 million euros to get a friendly resolution towards them in the European Parliament from one person.
Was it to organise the resolution?
I don't know what.
Can't just be to have signed something, was it?
And Eva Kaili, her father was found with 750,000 euros in cash in a briefcase and was arrested. But she's claiming that as a European Member of Parliament, she should have been immune from arrest. She's challenging the legal process.
How did the money get to the father?
So the claim is that her partner was somehow working with Antonio Panzeri, who clearly was corrupt. She panicked and was trying to get the cash out of their flat, and that she wasn't herself proposing to benefit from the cash. But there is an extraordinary number of wiretaps. The Belgian police have been all over it. And a lot of these wiretaps have been shared with journalists, and the story is just going to keep developing.
We've talked about this before, haven't we? This has been rumbling for months.
We have mentioned it before, but I do think it's worth remembering, because when we talk about threats to democracy, it's this sort of cash in people's flats. The third person also, I think, had 250,000 euros in cash in the son's flat. Then it turns out that the son, who had 250,000 euros in his flat, was a business partner of the judge who was investigating the case.
So, oh my God. And this is in the European Union. I know there's somebody who writes to me every single week on the back of our podcast and picks something in our podcast that says, do you still want to rejoin the European Union after this then? Now, what about this one? Laura Rutherford, is it time for a total rethink, rebuild of Ofsted? And how would you do it? Now, I'm imagining this is because of the awful conduct in the case of the head teacher who ended up taking her own life in the middle of an Ofsted inspection. Now, I think in general, inspection of schools, good thing. I think the culture of Ofsted has got a little bit out of control. You just hear from too many teachers and head teachers who are under massive stress anyway because of cuts and all the rest of it, but who find that the Ofsted experience has become utterly horrific. Now, how you get that balance right, I don't know, but I thought that the response of Ofsted saying that they're going to get the inspectors in for a day's training on the back of this didn't feel to me adequate in the face of what the coroner's findings were pretty awful.
It is awful. I think a lot about this because in prisons, I was trying to get the prison inspectors to be more modelled on Ofsted, by which I mean getting the Department of Justice, Ministry of Justice, to take the inspection scores as a way of measuring themselves. And I did think that, certainly in Cumbria, they were unbelievably stressful. When people got a negative report, they often felt it was deeply unfair. But it was also very important for parents to be able to have some kind of sense of an independent person coming in and looking at how school was performing. And often if you read the reports in detail, both for education and for prisons, they were really helpful. And I do think in government in general, you need independent inspectors because it's impossible, really.
We don't have them for government, though, do we?
We need them.
We don't have them for our MPs.
National Audit Office.
I suppose they do a bit. Yeah.
And one of the sad things is often they do these. The National Audit Office has just done another astonishing account of the Ministry of Defence, which yet again is kind of billions of pounds over budget and crazy bad procurement. And it's about taking the time to follow up on those stories because they do so much legwork.
Guy Verhofstadt was interesting on the way to save money on defence, wasn't he?
Yeah, very interesting on that.
I think people will enjoy Guy Verhofstadt. That's my third plug of him so far this week.
Okay, Alistair, loads more questions. Quick break.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Mm-hmm. I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Ben, does criticism from the public get to you? If not, did it once? How do you deal with it? Now, be serious about this. There presumably was a time when criticism from the public did bother you. I know that you're now more robust about these things.
I think I've always been quite robust.
Come on, how was it during the Iraq stuff? That must have been pretty horrible.
Yeah, it was horrible, but it wasn't horrible because of the criticism. It was horrible because of what was happening.
Right.
I don't think it does get to me. Maybe it should more than it does, but I don't think it does.
And when you go on Twitter and people just say war criminal,
honestly,
or whatever,
doesn't bother me.
Doesn't bother
it me. Really doesn't bother me. I've never ever blocked anybody on Twitter.
I think I've blocked one person on Twitter, but I haven't for many years.
Who was it?
A far right guy in my constituency who was making some pretty terrifying kind of nationalist threats.
I could be wrong about this, but I always think if somebody's threatening to kill you, the last place they're going to threaten is on social media, because the police have got a pretty good place to start looking for a suspect. Now, I don't think it does get to me. I had a big row the other day with one of our kids and about politics. And, you know, when he says things to me, that gets to me.
Right.
If Fiona and I have an argument, that politics, that gets to me.
But a random stranger doesn't get to you.
No, not really. And I guess the other thing that I know you're finding weird, because you told me, is this at the moment, because of the podcast, people constantly stopping me and saying nice things. I don't feel any different about it than I did when people were more likely to say something unpleasant. It only gets to me if I feel physically threatened.
Yeah. I was standing outside a shopping mall with my kids last week, and a Frenchman came up to me in the street and said, basically, your country is shit. You should be ashamed of yourself. You're a terrible politician. Everything about this country is shit. And I got really angry.
He said, oh, Monsieur le Président.
I spent 15 minutes shouting at this man and him shouting at me.
Were you shouting at him?
Yeah, because I got really angry and I kept saying to him, you know, how would it feel if I went to your country, went up to you randomly in the street and said, your country's shit? He said, well, my country's not shit. He said, your country's
shit.
Oh,
my God. Does he live here?
Yeah, he lives here. He works here.
Right.
And I said, why are you here? As you can imagine. And he said, just to make money and then I'm going back to France.
Oh, was he a banker? It was awful.
Anyway, I didn't like that. Question for you. John McIntyre, if the Tories remove Sunak, would it enhance or diminish their electoral hopes next year?
I think it would finish them. I think it would be...
Because you know there are people on the Tory right who are now fantasizing about bringing in a sort of Boris Farage combination.
Well, I know. It's just, I mean, I think what's happening with the Conservative Party, I felt this on the main podcast talking about, you know, the Star Chamber, Marc Francois has spoken. I don't think they have any sense of how ridiculous they look at the moment. I just think that Sunak looks to me like somebody who's floundering in the politics of all this. I don't think he quite knows how to deal with it.
The politics of all this is mad. I mean, if we just go back to this Rwanda thing, this was a as the Home Secretary said, I think James Coveney said, a batshit idea of Boris Johnson's in 2022, spring of 2022.
Which he now expects us to believe he thinks is a fantastic idea and the government can't survive without it.
Yeah. And it's a classic example of a loss of the way that Boris Johnson did politics, which is that he didn't bother to work out whether it was credible, whether it would get through the courts, whether you'd actually be able to send people to Rwanda before essentially signing a big check and saying he was going to do it. It then became sort of totemic, didn't it, for the right of the Conservative Party. So one of the reasons why, along with four much more mainstream pledges on inflation and growth, he put in Stop the Boats is presumably to placate the right of the party.
Totally.
Right? And as we can see, they continue to judge him on almost nothing else.
Absolutely.
It's the only thing that they care about. Yeah.
I think the two things he's got left, one is it would be absurd for them to try to get another prime minister before without a general election. I mean, look, we've had, since 2010, David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson.
Don't forget Liz Truss.
Liz Truss. Yeah. And Rishi Sunak. So we've had five prime ministers. We've now got more former prime ministers than at any time in our history. We're looking pretty ridiculous on the world stage. Sunak's not really cutting it, either domestically or globally, I don't think. Better than Johnson, better than Truss, but, you know, that's such a low bar. And who would they replace him with? Because
the idea being sold by Stephen Glover in the Daily Mail, which, of course, they're beginning to float all of them.
Do you read the Daily Mail?
I did on Monday to prepare for this podcast.
Did
I thought it was a very important thing to do.
Oh, wow.
I also looked at the Mirror. Incidentally, there is no news in the Mirror. It's absolutely extraordinary.
No.
There's like three news stories. The rest of it was celebrity stuff. I haven't looked at them recently.
They splash regularly on politics.
The Sun had more political news than the Mirror. And the Mail obviously has far, far more.
Yeah. Interesting.
I mean, the Mirror seemed pretty skinny to me.
The Daily Star had the best front page coverage of Johnson's COVID evidence.
What do they say?
It was an old cliche, but it was the longest nose you've ever seen. And it just said, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That's quite clever.
So apart from defending the Mirror. So in what they were saying in the Mail, or what Glover was saying in the Mail, is, and they're beginning to push, is this idea that Boris Johnson may have flaws, but he's an unbelievable campaigner and he's their one hope of trying to rupture.
Honestly, they're so deluded. They're so deluded. The public has seen right through that guy. Look, you've been at these events. We've done these events where you ask people their view. I'd say his ratings are pretty close to zero.
And I think it's a really good sign and it's quite encouraging. I don't know, we're often giving people gloomy news, but the fact that Britain has more than the US and a lot of European countries largely emerged from the complete madness of the sort of Corbyn, Boris Johnson era, it feels less populist actually. It feels as though Keir Starmer is going to be the next prime minister. Rishi Sunak is more in the centre than the right of his party. In some ways, Britain feels less divided, less polarised, certainly in the US, but also a lot of European countries.
Yeah, interesting. Related question, Samuel Murray, who will be the next leader of the Tory party?
Well, there is the big existential fight. I believe, and people would say, obviously I would believe, that the reason why the Tories are going to lose the next election is they went far too much to the crazy right, and that when we lose, we should learn that lesson and move back to the centre-left.
So who would that be?
It's a tough call because I'm maybe somebody like Jeremy Hunt. I don't know if he stayed around. Wow. Maybe James Cleverly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the likelihood is they'll learn exactly the wrong lesson and they will say, we weren't right-wing enough. And they will, Boris Johnson will probably try again, Suella Braverman will try,
but Johnson can't enter Parliament. He's banned from Parliament.
That is true.
That's a bit of a problem,
A bit of a problem.
And are you revising your scoffing of when I said that Farage will go for it at some point?
Well, it certainly feels as though some people are interested in that. And I think that will be the real sign that the Conservative Party is finished. By the time Nigel Farage is in the Conservative Party, any shreds of the party that I joined in 2010 under David Cameron will have gone completely.
Mm.
Now, childhood books is my final question. Mm-hmm. Vicky Ellams, you both obviously love reading. What books do you remember from your childhood that inspired you?
Am I allowed to say The Brunes and Urwally?
The Brunes and Urwally, that's very good.
I did look forward to them arriving every Christmas.
Gosh, did you read Roy of the Rovers?
Yes, I did.
You like Roy of the Rovers?
I did. I did quite like those sort of cartoony books.
I remember Roy of the Rovers.
Yeah.
I do remember.
No, but what was his name? What was the name of the team?
I can't remember.
I think it's Melchester.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good skills. Well, I loved it. Let me give it a stab. I loved some sort of medieval books. So I loved Ivanhoe. I loved a book called Bowman of Cressy. A lot of the books that I really loved and films I loved, I think now when I look back at them, are not really very suitable.
Violent.
Well, I think there's actually some pretty odd views about race and stereotypes. For example, I really liked a film called Those Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but,
great
but
film.
Watch it now.
Did you read
their
all that
impression,
sort of,
impression of the French and the Italians is a little stereotypical, to put it mildly.
Did you read the Jess William books?
I didn't do Jess William. You like Jess William?
I like Jess William. What about Jennings? Did you read Jennings?
No.
Jennings was a private school
was it?
Thing. Yeah. Maybe that's where my antipathy to private education
came from. Jennings.
Might have done.
I read Molesworth.
Yeah.
You remember Molesworth? So, yeah. Molesworth was like a comical private school guy, wasn't it? There was some posh bloke who had amazing conkers that he cooked in his castle oven.
I do remember Lord of the Flies having a big impact on me.
That's
I was quite young when I read that.
It's a chilling book, isn't it? But if it's a tough book too. I remember William Golding saying that he was finished as a writer once it became a school set text. But it's a terrifying book. I mean, my 9-year-old's been looking at it and just is very frightened by the idea of what kids can do.
Yeah. What are you reading right now?
I'm reading a book by C.S. Lewis called Mere Christianity.
I am reading Dominion by Tom Holland.
Very good.
Because he told me to read it in advance of us talking to him.
Our Christmas podcast.
We're going to do a Christmas podcast.
And finally on this one, I had a lovely conversation with the grandson of U Thant. U Thant, who was the UN Secretary General.
Mm-hmm.
This amazing figure in the 1960s, friend of Kennedy, friend of LBJ, vital in the early days trying to resolve the Vietnam War, and actually ruined his career in the end in the 67 war. It's a sort of precursor of what we're seeing now. The UN was considered not to have taken the right position against the Egyptians in the 67 invasion. But he was saying that when he was interviewed by, U Thant was interviewed by Alistair Cook, the great BBC American correspondent, all they talked about was children's books. And Alistair Cook said, all you needed to understand about this Burmese man who'd lived in a village until he was 42 as a small school teacher is he'd had a completely Edwardian British childhood, and all he wanted to talk about were sort of G.A. Henty books and all these kind of books that people read in late Victorian, early Edwardian England.
Ahead of the Albert Holland Thursday, I have the onerous duty and privilege of doing the eulogy at Glenys Kinnock's funeral. And one of the observations I make about her is that when our three children were born, she didn't bring clothes. She brought books, lots of books for babies up to five. So she brought a whole library.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
My friend Robert Craig from Cymru, he's a Cymruan dairy farmer. He and his wife Jackie, when our kids were born, brought some amazing books, none of which I'd actually seen before, which were the most lovely things. I think they introduced me to the Gruffalo. They also introduced me for the first time to Harry McClary.
Harry McClary.
And all the dogs in Harry McClary's team, which includes Hector Morse, as big as a horse.
Oh, I used to, when the kids were growing up, I liked Shirley Hughes. Baba, like Baba.
Baba's brilliant.
Baba.
Brilliant.
Okay, I think we're done, Rory.
Thank you very much. See you next week.
See you soon.